Welcome to podcast number 85 of My Favorite Detective Stories. Today's date is January 21st, 2020, and I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Our guest this week is Max Wirestone. He is the writer of the Dahlia Moss Mystery Series, and most recently, the winner of the Best Original Private Eye Paperback, awarded by the Seamus Awards this year in BoucherCon in Dallas in late October and early November. He is a librarian by day, dad by night, and a ne'er-do-well in most of the times in between. He lives in Kansas with his husband, son, and altogether too many books. We explore his mysteries set in the gaming community, as well as the four queens of crime, Agatha Christie, Nao Marsh, Dorothy Sayers, and Marjorie Allingham. It's a fun romp through 80, 90 years of crime fiction writing and detective stories. Welcome to My Favorite Detective Stories. My Favorite Detective Stories features successful private investigators. They offer insights into their careers and advice to those just starting out or to those who are struggling. We will learn from the best. Of course, we cannot finish the show without asking them to share their favorite detective story. On alternating weeks, we will hear from crime fiction writers who discuss their latest books and what makes their fictional detectives tick. Throughout my investigative career spanning five decades, I cannot think of a time that I didn't have a good crime novel on my coffee table or bedstand. We will also talk about their favorite authors as well. As a working investigator, coach, and writer, I hope to bring inspiration, information, and entertainment in the areas that interest me most. Gather around my campfire as I invite you to listen in. This episode is brought to you by my own crime thriller with a mystery twist, Odessa on the Delaware. A Russian gang enforcer is on a murderous rampage to take over the entire Philadelphia mob scene. A homeless vet doesn't know that he has the proof or that he's next on the list. The stakes are high for this deadly cat and mouse game set on the bleak Philly waterfront of years gone by. FBI agent Marcia O'Shea, a gunslinger from the Miami cartel days, is back in her hometown, quietly finishing out her career, but now is drawn into this case with a secret pushing her doggedly to follow the clues, only to uncover a greater secret that may get her killed in the final showdown. You can buy Odessa from your favorite online retailer. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So how's the weather down there in Kansas today?
Well, by Kansas standards, it's cold, but by, you know, more reasonable parts of the Northeast, it would be very, very warm. Okay. So,
and is it as windy as they say Kansas can be at times?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, out there in the plains.
Yeah, for sure. Here in the Northeast today, as I record this on November 15th, it's winter is telling us that they're coming a little early. And and to be prepared, because we have a chilly day and high winds and a wind chill factor that puts us in the teens. So not exactly mid-November weather, but just the same harbinger of things to come, I'm afraid to say. So I'm so happy that you came on the podcast. I really appreciate taking the time to sit down with me. But congratulations are in order. You are the winner of the 2019 Seamus Award for Best Original Private Eye Paperback.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah. And the questionable behavior of Dahlia Moss. And I was a judge for the best private eye short story, so I couldn't talk to any of those authors until after the awards were announced, because I couldn't show any favoritism, as you imagine. But I was just so happy to be able to speak with many of the authors of the best original private eye. So tell me about your writing, and tell me about how the idea of this book came about, and tell me about Dahlia Moss.
Oh, sure. Well, this is the third book in a series, but the whole origin of it, I'm a librarian in my day job, and I just was ordering books for the library. I, you know, did collection development, and which is a hard thing to do. You're trying to pick out what people want.
Sure.
Which is, you know, easier said than done sometimes. And I noticed that, like, fantasy was really popular. We had, like, a Game of Thrones book club that was going at the time, and I noticed that everybody that was doing that book club was also, you know, they're also big mystery readers. And I thought, well, that's odd. That's not really what I would have expected necessarily. So I thought, in the back of my mind, I had, you know, I have all these kind of, there are all these hobby cozies. I'm not necessarily a huge fan of them, but you have cozies for like every hobby you can think of, John. Like, mm-hmm. Quilting cozies, there's upholstery, there's, you know, but there are all these sort of, for lack of a better term, like feminine hobbies a little bit. And I thought, well, maybe it'd be fun to try to kind of take that angle and do a book that was not exactly a cozy, but like a, played with some of the elements of a mystery genre and then paired that with sort of internet culture or geek culture. And because that's something I hadn't seen represented anywhere, and sort of try to kind of smush these things together in a way that I hadn't seen done before. That was kind of the origin of Dahlia Moss, which almost began more in kind of the cozy tradition, because she began as a... as an amateur private eye, or just an amateur detective. Mm-hmm. And then kind of over the course of the series has moved into it professionally. The third book closes with her actually becoming a private investigator.
And so. Tell me again where the setting is for all of her misadventures.
That's St. Louis. St. Louis, yeah. So the big city in the Midwest.
Yes, it is. Been there many a time. And it reaches out into a large suburban area on both sides of the river as well. So for sure. So so you've written three books now in the series. Tell me a little bit about each of the books, the back blurb, if I could be so bold as to say.
Oh, sure. The first book is kind of I had the idea for it and I was playing a lot of, I don't know how much of a gamer you are, but, you know, people play games like World of Warcraft or these games where they're playing online and then they make friends kind of all around the world through the process of playing this game. And I thought that would be a very interesting idea for like a murder mystery. Like, suppose someone in kind of your online group gets murdered and there's a crime or a theft. That just seemed like an interesting backdrop for a murder mystery. So that's what that first book is. It's kind of taking there's literally like a lot of online investigation that goes on in it. The second book takes place at a gaming tournament, and it uses a lot of Twitch. I think one of the things that book does most successfully is, I don't know if you're familiar with the Twitch streaming service, but like there's a lot of investigation that goes on through there. There's a lot of broadcasting of kind of this murder mystery. And the final book is a little bit more traditional. It's a little bit more of a traditional mystery. I was trying to find different ways to kind of play with online culture and kind of bring that into mysteries and hopefully bring maybe some younger readers into kind of the kinds of mysteries I like.
Now, is the series all published through Red Hook Books?
Yes, they've done the whole trilogy.
Okay. Tell me just a little bit about your publisher. I'm not familiar with it. I apologize.
Oh, sure. No, Red Hook, it's funny. I feel like an oddity a little bit. Red Hook is honestly what it is the Orbit is a science fiction publishing house, which is part of Little Brown. And so basically it's like the science fiction people really like something at Orbit and they want to publish it, but it's not science fiction, then they call it a Red Hook book. So really, I'm kind of with Orbit. So it's a lot of science fiction writers that I'm honestly not that well read on, but that's why I feel like a little bit of an outcast. So it's part of Little Brown.
All right. I think you have a tiger by the tail with that series, quite frankly. But let me ask you a question. I mean, this is more of a reader demographic question. Do gamers read outside of gaming? I mean, I don't mean that impolitely. I just don't.
Oh, no. Well, I don't, I'm not sure. It's interesting. I think the most successful book has been the third, which is the one that got kind of the furthest away from the idea. Maybe not. I do like the idea of kind of... I like to try to bring people in. Now, I like games, right? It's part of my life. It's part of my son's life. So it feels natural for me to kind of weave that into the fabric of a mystery. Mm-hmm. But I think it's maybe telling that the third book's kind of the one that's the furthest away from that world is the one that I think has been best received. We'll see.
And maybe part of it is because it really hasn't been given a front and center view by the gaming community. Yet. And I use the word yet, Matt, Max. So let me ask you, tell me a little bit about Dahlia. What makes her quirky? What makes her unique? What makes her different going from amateur to professional?
I think that she's someone who, she began with a kind of a lot of, in some ways, she's modeled a little bit about on myself in the sense of there's kind of that period in your 20s where you don't know what you're doing and you feel like people are maybe more successful than you and you're just kind of meandering about. So I wanted to kind of pick a character who was kind of in that, you finish college, but you don't really know what you're doing, kind mm-hmm. of point in your life, and, have her kind of just realize that this was something that she was really good at, and kind of, sort of find her path that way. So in a weird way, it's kind of like I mean, it's obviously a traditional mystery, and I'm obviously hitting all of those beats, but it's also about someone kind of discovering, you know, what they're meant to do or discovering what they're good at. And I think that the way I approach her and the way I approach her characters is different than you would see in like traditional mystery or a cozy or a Private Eye book. There's a little bit more kind of development in terms of just, I mean, it's what happens when you hit 25, right? You have to figure out, oh, I have something in my life. What is it going to be? You know, why not this? So
yeah, and you're right, because in my readings, that sort of post-adolescence, having to be an adult, adulting is not really front and center. I'm using another same term I just used before, in character development of the various characters. Most are hard drinking alcoholics.
Sure. Well, there's some of that as well. You know, there's plenty of drinking in that series, but I mean, I like the idea of kind of taking some of the, I think some of the things that maybe you could be paralyzing in your mid twenties, that she's, you know, sort of paranoid and insecure, but like that paranoia is actually not a terrible trait for a detective to have. You know, her kind of observant. She's very observant in a way that can sometimes, either she can beat herself up, but that same skill is what makes her good at being a detective.
Yeah. So. But these aren't learned skills from her education. These are more natural or intuitive.
Yeah, exactly. She has a very expensive business degree that is doing nothing for her. Although I guess, you know, she's able to start her own business finally. But yeah. Like initially she is, she's just dealing with student debt and, I mean, like one of the reasons she's doing this effectively is like, how am I going to make my loan payments? I've got to, mm-hmm. I've got to pay the bill. So, right.
That's interesting. That is a fresh look at it. I mean, really. And the fact that it's happening in the first couple books, somewhat in the gamer community, which is in itself has its own culture. Can you just talk about that a little bit, you know, for some of my readers that may not be as familiar with the gaming community?
Oh sure. I mean, it's becoming really mainstream. And that's one of the things that I was kind of sort of finding is that, you think of, you have like gaming tournaments. The second book takes place at a gaming tournament where she's attending live. And, but like those things are now broadcast. They're on ESPN, you know, 6 or 7 or, mm-hmm. But like they're literally like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that watch us online. And so it's a big audience, you know, but I mean, it's an interesting space. It obviously skews a little bit younger. I think most people that follow that scene are kind of in their 20s. Mm-hmm. Maybe 30s, maybe sometimes younger than 20s, but it's generally a very millennial sort of space.
And Gen Z.
Yeah, and Gen Z. It's very racially diverse. It's also kind of a more masculine space. So having a female main character is interesting and gives you kind of interesting things to work with.
Sure.
She's a little bit of a fish out of water, but obviously when you write a mystery, you want to have interesting characters and a great plot and a good hook, but it's nice to have ground that has not been, some of the ground has been so well trod before by really excellent writers before you. It's nice to find a space that maybe hasn't been as well. What's attractive about it to me?
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that I notice that I'll be watching a football game on a Sunday afternoon, and between the truck and beer commercials, there comes a Call of Duty commercial. And they make it so realistic. It's like a darn movie trailer, you know?
Sure.
And then I might be at a movie theater, literally. And what do they have playing? But trailers for the newest game that's coming out with Xbox. I mean, it's really crazy how mainstream it is. And it's not only just kids in their basements in Midwestern cities. It's international. You could be gaming with somebody from all over the world, right?
Yeah, sure. No, and I think one of the give me a lot of fun things to play with in the first book, you know, that explores a lot of that space, because you can forge what feel like real relationships with people, and in fact maybe really are real relationships with people, you know, countless stories of people having met someone online and then they get married and start a family. But like, you know, you don't really know who you're playing with. That's one of the fun things about that first mystery that I wrote, is that, you know, just kind of investigating this online group of people that play together, and you know, people are very different than their personas, you know, that the person that you think is, a successful professional is just a little kid. The person that you think is maybe just a little kid is a successful professional. Mm-hmm. It's like a masquerade ball, which is always a fun element to have in a mystery.
So. Well, that's for sure. I mean, I think you've really done a nice job. Look at, Agatha Christie with Hercule Poirot. And the first, but one of the biggest one is the Murderer on the Orient Express.
Sure.
You put these characters, and they are characters, international characters, people that you are completely out of role, in role, but yet one of them's a murderer and it's all taking place on a train. I mean, you know, what a hook that was. I mean, I'm just saying that out loud.
Sure.
But it just seems like you got a real fresh take on a setting that is unique and not your everyday setting. So, and that the judges at Seamus could see the freshness in your writing and see the novelty of your idea in this third book, The Questionable Behavior of Dahlia Moss. What are the other, if you said it earlier, I apologize because we had that little glitch there. What are the names of the other two books?
Oh, let's see if I can remember. The publisher renamed them, so let's see if I can remember. They are Astonishing Mistakes, second one, and Unfortunate Decisions. So The Unfortunate Decisions of Dahlia Moss, The Astonishing Behavior of Dahlia Moss, Questionable Behavior is third.
Yeah, I get the riff there.
Yeah, so yeah.
I know.
That's a publisher-derived system. But I like, yeah, they're fun books. I like the title. But I've never successfully titled a book. Whatever I come up with, it's always replaced. So,
right. You know. Well, you're just going to have to get a better set of beta readers, that's all. You know, you're going to have to A-B split test those yourself. I'm joking, of course, you realize.
Sure.
So was Dahlia your first dabbling in writing, or had you written before that?
I very little bits. You know, I would do, it looks like I'm a librarian, and every so often I'd push the NaNoWriMo, the National Novel Writing Month, now trying to get people to do it. The best way to get people to do something like that is to do it, and then kind of like, we're doing it together.
Mm-hmm.
It was never really with the intention of having a finished novel. It was more like, this is an activity. We're going to do this. Right. And I had some ideas that were fun, but, I just had this idea, you know, when I was ordering books one day, it was like, someone should write like a kind of an internet themed mystery. That's a really good idea. Someone should do that. You know, that would work. And then, as months passed and I kept ordering books and I couldn't, literally my original idea was I was just going to order it from my library. I was like, I should find that mystery. Whoever wrote it, I'll find it and I'll order it for the library because it would play well here. And then when nobody wrote it, I was like, well, I'll write it. And yeah, that's what happened.
And three books into it, you get nominated and win an award for your writing. Yo, how about that, huh?
Yeah, you know, so I guess if you're out there and you're thinking there's a void, you know, my advice would be to just don't wait for anybody else to fill it. Just, you know, if you think you can do it yourself. So
I wouldn't even worry about filling a void, even though that's a good idea commercially and as well as deciding if you want to do something fresh, that you don't want to walk down the same trail somebody else has before, you know, the mean streets of New York or, the sultry winds blowing off the Santa Anas in LA. I mean, you know, if you don't want to do that, yeah, sure. But, you know, let's face it. My advice to anybody that wants to write is if you don't do it, you will regret it. So take the time. Put, you know, pencil to paper, get your, you know, fanny in the seat, hands on the keyboard and do it. Now, if you have to learn how to do it, that's part of the hobby. That's part of, you know, getting to be a better craftsperson at writing. But just do it, because if you don't, you'll always regret it. My very favorite story is for myself that I tell is that I had an idea kicking around in my head for 20 years. I had the beginning, I had the end, but I didn't have the middle. And then the one day when the middle came to me, I started jabbering to my son, who's an adult at the time, about this story. And he looked at me like I had just come in from a foreign planet. He said, what are you talking about? And I said, I've had this story kicking around in my head for years. This is how it began. This is how it ended. This is the middle. This is how they get from, you know, point A to point B to point C. And he says, but you don't know how to write. And I said, I'll learn how to write. And that became my writing career from that point forward. I learned how to write. I learned how to write fiction. I learned how to write in other genres. And I just enjoying it. But what about that person that doesn't want to, that's afraid to do so, that's timid or thinking that they're not going to be the next James Patterson or the next, Dan Brown, right? It doesn't have to be that. They can just be the next, the better version of themselves.
And sure. Yeah. You're the next you. You know, you don't have to be the next James Patterson. I'm certainly not the next James Patterson. I mean, I think it just feels good to do, you know, mm-hmm. If you have a story, letting it out is, you know, very gratifying. You learn things about yourself. And, you know, each one you do gets better. I mean, it's no accident that, you know, I got nominated for this third book. Nothing happened for the first two. You know, just because each time you do it, you get better. You know, you learn by doing.
The
the Da Vinci Code was Dan Brown's fourth book. Can you name the first three? I can't. So you know, I'm not being mean,
sure,
you know,
no.
And he'll be the first to admit it, you know?
Sure.
So,
you just have to do it. I mean, it's a humbling process and, you know, it's tough too. I think Neil Gaiman, the science fiction writer, has written about this a little bit, but he was saying, you know, when you read, if you're a voracious reader, you have a very clear idea of what excellent writing looks like in whatever genre it is that you like to read. And, you know, it can be very hard when you first start writing. You know, you're not achieving the level of which you like to read at. So there's, you know, when you start, you're just going to be bad or relatively bad to whatever you're used to reading. And you just kind of have to get through that, you know?
Right. Look, I like to tell people that the only difference between me and Ernest Hemingway is I'm still alive and I've got plenty. And but I don't mean that in a mean sense, but that it's just the number of books we sold. That's it. But otherwise, you know, we're both authors. We're both writers.
Well, that's one of the things I've done stuff with different writers and different people in the writing community. I that's one of the things I've really found is it's really interesting. We were talking earlier about kind of I'm in orbit, just sort of more science fiction-y publishing house. But like, you know, it doesn't matter when I'm interacting with another writer, whether they write science fiction or like Harlequin romance or whatever they're doing, like we have so much more in common than people that don't write, you know. We're all battling the same thing. We're all battling the blank page. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're listening to this podcast and thinking about, you know, about writing, join our tribe, be one of us, you know.
Oh yeah. And don't be afraid to go to a writer's group and just sit and watch and see how they do it a little bit, get the lay of the land, and then maybe do some flash fiction, do a prompt, do something that is a short story, do something and see how other people react to it. I belong to the Written Word in Milford, Connecticut. I am giving a shout out to my peeps, and they're the best group of people ever. I have science fiction writers, I have steampunk, I've got romance, I've got poets there, I've got a person that's writing a memoir that will, I can't tell you about it right now, but it has legs. And it's just something that I just marvel at all the different skills that they bring to the table, but I learn from them. I learn about description, I learn about setting, I learn about concept. I also learn about the crap that I write and how I could write it better, you know? And to me, I think that's one of the things that people can do to definitely up their skill sets, you know, and by just getting involved, maybe getting into a group, maybe do it even online. It's a way to do that online these days. So for sure. Hey, let's just switch gears a little bit. One of the things that I like to ask my writers that come on is about their favorite writers and maybe a hidden jewel in the rough. And you mentioned one to me before we came on, and I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Sure. Well, I was going to mention a book by Nio Marsh. She's a New Zealand writer. That name is N-G-A-I-O. It's kind of I think it's a New Zealand name, an Aboriginal name, although she was born in England and moved out to New Zealand. She wrote around mostly the 1940s, 30s, 50s, really all the way to the 80s. But she's one of the original four queens of crime, along with Agatha Christie, who's the most famous of them, Dorothy Sayers, and Marjorie Allingham. I love Nio Marsh. She is a fantastic writer, just fantastic, who I feel like has been forgotten a little bit. You know, if you think of the original Four Queens of Crime, you know, Agatha Christie is obviously all about plots, just plots that can't be beat, and people are still doing her stuff, you know, however many years later. But Marsh was really the character writer of those four people. Mm-hmm. She just wrote really fascinating character studies, and she was someone who had really fallen in love with her characters a little bit. One of my favorite books of hers is a book called Color Scheme, which actually takes place in like a hot springs in New Zealand during World War II. Or maybe right before World War II. And this is, you know, a place that she grew up. She has a very, she's writing about a very specific commonplace that is really vividly written. And, but she loves her character so much that John, the murder in this book does not come in until almost 3/4 of the way through the book. Like, you can forget that you're reading a murder mystery, or you kind of start to play a game. There's something kind of ingenious that happens where you start to kind of play this game with Nio Marsh, where you're trying to figure out who is going to be murdered. Because you're like, you know, it's a murder mystery. You know, someone's going to get murdered. So you find yourself trying to predict and solve the crime before it happens.
Wow, that's neat.
It's a great piece of writing. And it's also just this really vivid picture of this world. I mean, what do you know about New Zealand, Aboriginal New Zealand in 1940? I mean, speaking for me, not much. Mm-hmm. But like, this is a girl who grew up there. And so it's very vividly painted. And it's just a great mystery. And she has a lot of really fantastic mysteries. And I think she's been forgotten a little bit. If you're a fan of kind of, she's very traditional, but if you're a fan of that kind of traditional mystery genre, she's fantastic. And I would highly recommend Color Scheme.
And she's written others as well?
Oh, yeah. She's probably written, she's a real contemporary of Agatha Christie. So she's probably written 30 to 40 to maybe 50 books. She wrote all throughout that whole period. And, you know, she put out like a book a year. And most of her writing is really very good. She keeps to a pretty high standard. Mm. I think, you know, kind of not unlike her, as she kind of hitting the 70s and 80s, and maybe they get a little bit dodgier. But she's really great, and she should be checked out. I'm also a big fan of Marjorie Allingham's, also writer period. So if you think of Agatha Christie as kind of the plot writer, and, you know, Niall Marsh is sort of the character writer. Marjorie Allingham, I would describe as the booze writer.
Booze?
Yeah. She literally was. Okay, she's a female mystery writer. She looks like a bulldog a little bit. She's a British writer. She was literally the, in like 1930s, 1940s, she was the, not a mascot, but she was the spokesperson for a brand of like bourbon.
Okay.
Which tells you a lot, all you need to know about her books. There's a lot of drinking in her books. You know, you know, the drinking is well appreciated, and she's great fun. I mean, she's a really good time.
And I spell Marjorie with a J, J-O-R.
Marjorie with a G, M-A-R-G-E-R-Y, Marjorie Allingham. And yeah, wow. She's great fun. I mean, a little frothy, but like, she's great. And yeah, it's funny that Christie is the person we all remember from that kind of that period. But I think there's some really great other writers have kind of gotten, you know, forgotten a little bit. But definitely Marsh is the way. If you're only going to read one, you should read Niall Marsh book. She's really okay. A great writer. So.
No, I like that. And I like the fact that, you know, you talked about both of their books really having fresh settings. Mm-hmm. Maybe not so much Marjorie with, you know, the fact that she was a bourbon spokesperson, you know, I kind of get it there. But, you know, realistically, I mean, it really does cover some different type of writing. It's not the Clive Cussler's, the Lee Childs, you know, this is something that's different, unique, has its own twist, its own spin. And not to say anything negative about Mr. Cussler or Childs, but just saying, you know, they're different, and they go about it differently.
And they're not exactly from the private eye, too. I don't know what you exactly would call those. There's been this bifurcation of mystery a little bit, you think, since the 1930s. We kind of have moved down. You have sort of the, and I don't love this division, but it's kind of what we've got. You know, you kind of have this side that, well, I don't like the word cozy even, but you have kind of that side of fiction and have sort of the more private eye aspect of fiction. And they used to be more together, I feel like. And I feel like they've diverged in the past years. But,
As you get keywords and subgenre typing in Amazon,
yeah,
you're going to get more and more of that. Unfortunately, yeah. I hate to say.
Sure.
But you know what? The way I look at it, I write what I want to write. If it crosses genre, okay, crosses genre. Is it something that I'm going to have trouble pigeonholing within one of those categories? Well, maybe so. Does that bother me? Do I stay awake at night worrying about that? Hell no.
No. It can't. And the genres change over time anyway. You know, you can't keep up with it. But I didn't mention this to you, but ahead of time, are you much a reader of, have you read much Raymond Chandler? Are you a fan of Raymond Chandler?
I'm going to pause on that and say, when I was told to read the classics, I wasn't being told to read Shakespeare or Beowulf. I was told to read, you know, the classics of fiction, Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and Ross Macdonald. And they are like maybe the three pillars of pulp fiction going into mainstream. And of course, I read the annotated version of The Big Sleep that was done about Raymond Chandler and The Big Sleep. And I looked at it, and I looked at his writing from that viewpoint, and I found that he really didn't appeal to me. And maybe I'm being blasphemous by saying that, but I'm kind of a plot-driven guy. And when you have people that are getting murdered in a book and you don't tie those loose ends up, you know, I have a little bit of an issue with that.
Oh, yeah. The big sleep gets real gauzy.
And then when you have, when you're a fan of the movie and then you read the book and you find out, oh, it's a little different in the book, you know, and you're not as much a fan of the book. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
And that's not usually the case. Usually I'm a big fan of the book and the movie doesn't do it justice. So there's exceptions, of course. People will rail at me for that. But, you know, his, I look at Chandler and I see Well, good writing, honestly. I see the similes, the way he uses similes, much like the way Dashiell Hammett uses similes. And boy, that became a trope in themselves.
Yeah, they kind of invented the genre a little bit between the two of them.
Yeah. But you know what? When I read the annotated version of The Big Sleep and somebody else picked it apart, and they were trying to be a fan. And I'm like, no, it doesn't really work for me. You know, the book didn't work for me. And some of his other writings just didn't work for me. I like a thriller that will, I can't wait to turn the next page. I like a tight plot. I like the fact that characters have their issues in the beginning and are trying to resolve their issues, and they get more stuff dropped on them during the book and makes their issues worse. But in the end, they somehow are able to pull it together. A well-written thriller in that case is one that I think has the main character coming to a successful conclusion at the end. There is no deus ex machina, deus ex machina, you know, coming in to save the day at the end. It's coming from the character's ability or combined with luck and pluck, you know. Does that make sense, Max?
Oh, of course. I mean, and like, I'm with you on The Big Sleep. The Big Sleep is a real gauzy novel in the sense of like, there are threads that never kind of get up. But having said all that, I'm going to pitch to you a largely forgotten Raymond Chandler novella that nobody's really aware of, but it's a hoot. You should take a look at it. Readers, take a look at it. It's called Pearls Are Noose, and it's just a novella. It's not even a full-length novel, like a long short story. And it's Raymond Chandler kind of writing your classic Raymond Chandler book with like the, you know, the private eye world, just all the tropes that you would expect. But in the middle of it, the main character, rather than being the typical hard-beaten private eye, is this sort of professor of English who's kind of a thought, for a lack of a better term. He has this crush on this fiance, but he's a very delicate man who has no business whatsoever in a private eye novel. And it is maybe the funniest piece of writing. If I were told I had like a half hour left to live, I get to read something for a half hour, I would take that. It's very, very funny. It's Raymond Chandler at his funniest. And it's just a hoot. You should take it out. And it's short enough that Raymond Chandler can't get lost in his own details, as he sometimes does. So.
Well, I'd rather have a bubble bath with Margot Robbie for my last half hour on my I'm sure my wife wouldn't appreciate that, but you know,
she'd be busy with her own half hour time.
Thank you, Max. Thank you for mentioning that. True. You got me speechless on that one. So anyhow, Pearls Are a Nuisance, a Chandler novella. Marjorie Allingham and
Niall Marsh. I'm going real old school today.
That's all right. Well, you know what? What I'm going to be doing after the first of the year is, besides, you know, making sure that my podcast gets to a different listener base through Instagram, I want to bring out these oldies and goodies and maybe get a tutorial description of a scene and have the quote from that scene and then mention the name of the book and the name of the author so that people can get into these old school authors and have a visual representation of it. And that's how I'm planning to do something on Instagram next year. I just think that, you know, yeah, I can send cat videos until my heart's content, but realistically, I think that there are scenes that these authors describe that with a little bit of imagination and stock photographs, I can do something there with some of the best quotes exhibiting that scene or that concept. But anyway, anybody else you'd like to talk about while we're on a roll?
Well, I mean, I think I mentioned you ahead of time. Like, so kind of the way I got into mysteries, my parents were both just voracious mystery readers.
Okay.
And they had this, you know, this closet in their bedroom that was just filled up with like yellowed paperbacks that, you know, you would read or they would read. I was too young to read them. I spent a lot of my 20s and 30s going back and like reading all of these books that my parents had read. And I'm a big, my tastes run a little bit old school, but I'm a big fan of a lot of kind of those writers. You know, most of them are people that are super famous and everyone would be aware of. Nero Wolfe. I mean, Earl Stanley Gardner.
Sure.
I've read so many Earl Stanley Gardners. And I mean, like,
the creator of
Perry Mason.
Perry Mason, yes.
But he also has another series called Bertha Cool. I don't know if you know Bertha Cool.
No.
She's great. She's fantastic. She's a sort of a female private investigator this sort of very heavy set woman in the 1930s. And she's great. He wrote a lot of series. Wolf is great fun. I like, I'm blanking on her name right now. She wrote the Mrs. Pollifax series, but she also has some mysteries that she wrote as well. Oh, I can't think of her name right now. But
our listeners will be screaming at you.
That's right, you fool. I really like, there's so much, I really like going back to learning that stuff. I find it really gratifying in a way that, and I think one of the challenges writing a mystery now with the internet, which is ironic because I'm obviously writing great internet have mysteries, but so much is available to you. Like if you wanted to find something out as a detective, you can just Google your mm-hmm. answers.
Well, yes and no.
Yes and no. Yes and no. But I think it's rewarding to read, to go back to a period where, some of the investigation is harder or mm-hmm. is a little more labor intensive in a different way. And
No, but I got to be honest with you. I think what you did with your first two novels and a little bit of your third one involving Dahlia was very unique. You had to do your research. You had to get into that story world, which is a real life, everyday world. But many people are not a part of it. If they're not part of the gaming world, it's... you might as well be on safari somewhere. But that's on TV. At least you can see safaris on TV.
Well, sure.
And
that was one of the ways I went into it, too, is I had this viewpoint as I was writing for different audiences. I'm writing for mystery audiences that might not understand the gaming world, and I'm writing for gamers that might not familiar with kind of the trope. So I worked really hard. So let's say you've never done any kind of gaming at all. I worked really hard to kind of make you feel integrated. And so it's not like this brick of culture you're hitting all at once. But right. Dolly's a little bit of an outsider, and she's kind of the viewpoint character for someone who's maybe not a gamer, kind of leads them into this world. So yeah,
I like that. I like that a lot. And I think Red Hook Books has a nice series on their hand. On their hands. I think you've got a nice book. Now, is there going to be a fourth Dahlia Moss?
Probably not a fourth Dahlia Moss. I feel like that story's going to reach its end. I'm working on another series right now that's another mystery series, but it's a little bit more of a kind of... I don't know if I want to talk about it too much, but you don't have to.
I mean, just sure. But you're giving Dahlia a breather, and you're moving on to something else.
Yes, that's true.
All right. So everybody can get your books online, and are they out in the bookstores as well?
I hope so. I mean, they're available online on Amazon or any traditional, wherever books are sold, and check out your bookstores, your public libraries, said the public librarian. And give it a go. I think the books, don't need to be read in order. You could read them out of order. And I'm particularly proud of the third book. I think the third book is a really great, it's just very strong on its own. So if you want to start somewhere, I would suggest maybe starting with that and then working your way back.
Okay. But, The Questionable Behavior of Dahlia Moss by Max Wirestone. And how can people reach you if they want to get in touch with you, if they have a question, Max?
Sure. Well, I have a website at maxwirestone.com. You can follow me on Twitter at MacWires. And I'm around.
All right, Max. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. My guest next week is Rod Gagnon. Rod started in the distressed asset investigations business in 1984 with a repossession agency in New Hampshire when he was just a few years out of high school. From that simple beginning, he has gone on to specialize in financial fraud investigations and enforcement of court judgments that range from $1,000 to $20 million from California to Florida. The work includes finding financial account relationships in the U.S. and offshore, locating hidden real estate, corporations, boats, planes, art, unknown beneficial interests, and third parties with deeper pockets. Besides working with creditors and law firms with asset recovery plans and ongoing support, he also has become an expert and a fact witness. Currently, he is a certified fraud examiner and a PI Trade Association board member, treasurer in Colorado and cash treasurer in New Hampshire, and currently resides in Denver, Colorado, along with his wife, children, and grandchildren, and he still supports the Patriots over the Broncos. I'm sure that goes over well in the Mile High City. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear other great detective stories, please go to the website and click on our podcast page. There you will find the backlist. Now, you're probably asking, John, what about your own stories? Do you have any? Sure enough, I do. And they are available to you free as a download right to your inbox. I have 8 short stories and 8 vignettes in a book titled Mugshots, My Favorite Detective Stories. Now, here's my ask. You were either informed, inspired, or entertained by the stories today. Don't be bashful. Share this link with your friends. Better still, go to the iTunes website and leave a review. It's the best way to grow the circle around our campfire. If you have any questions, please contact me through the website, www.johnhoda.com, J-O-H-N-H-O-D-A.com. Thanks so much, and have a great day.